I'll try not to keep anyone past six. And that'll be easy because Rolf did a lot of my presentation for me. Thank you, Rolf. I have no relationships to disclose. So today I just want to wrap up the session by discussing the regulatory gaps surrounding triclosan. So I'll elaborate a little bit on Rolf's discussion of triclosan and its human health effects and how it applies to each of us as consumers. And then I'll move on to the challenge of precautionary policy making with such a broken system. So in the 1960s, triclosan was made by SIBO Corporation. It was originally used in surgical scrubs, so it was primarily limited to the healthcare setting. And today it's in thousands of products, including your antibacterial hand soaps, toothpaste, mouthwash, dish detergent, children's toys, pet materials. So if you have those pet dispensing food containers and waters that kind of look like the water bottles back there, they are often impregnated with Microban, which is a trade name for triclosan. And all of those sales that you and I make make a lot of money for big corporations like SIBA and now BASF. So it's about $1 billion industry, annual industry. And right now, about 75% of liquid hand soaps and 30% of bar soaps contain either triclosan or triclocarbon. And as Rolf mentioned, one of the main health concerns is that triclosan bioaccumulates in humans and in animals. So triclosan can be found in blood, urine, breast milk, and umbilical cord blood, which I'll just point out is another public health crisis issue, the idea that babies are being born pre-polluted by the mother's chemical burden. So human levels of triclosan in urine, the concentrations have risen 41%. This is data from last year, and it looked at triclosan levels in 2004 versus 2006. So at best guess, in 2006, we were using more triclosan than ever before. And part of the reason that, well, the reason that we're talking about triclosan today is it's linked to antibiotic resistance. The primary concern is that antibacterial agents may select for bacteria that are resistant to them and then also cross-resistant to antibiotics. Rolf touched on this as well, that endocrine disruption and the environmental impacts, especially of endocrine disruption, are quite severe with triclosan, and it's very toxic, as he mentioned, to algae, fish, etc. So the USGS has identified triclosan as one of the most frequently detected contaminants in U.S. streams and waterways, and at some of the highest concentrations. As Rolf mentioned, because it's not entirely eliminated through the wastewater treatment process, we're finding triclosan in sewage sludge that's applied to land, some land that may be used for agricultural purposes as well. And a study that came out this past year by Wu et al. Showed that in a greenhouse study, recycled irrigated wastewater and recycled sewage sludge was able to be transported through the roots of soybean plants, through the stems, through the leaves, and into the actual beans themselves. This has quite an impact on what we have previously not known about its impact on the food system and contamination of the food web. So, as Rolf mentioned, there are all of these problems, and one would think that there must be some really wonderful reason why we use triclosan if it comes with all of these potential implications. And similar to what Dr. Silbergeld discussed, triclosan in consumer products is just, it's not therapeutic. It doesn't work. And an EPA quote from last year is, at this time, FDA does not have evidence that triclosan added to antibacterial soaps and body washes provide extra health benefits over soap and water. So we have the American Medical Association saying that in 2000, an FDA advisory panel saying that in 2005,
and EPA saying that in 2010, and yet it's still on the market.
So I want to talk mainly about the regulatory failures and why triclosan is still on the market. So EPA regulates triclosan under the federal food, FIFRA, which is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. And EPA registrations for triclosan are those where triclosan is used to stop the growth or slow the growth of bacteria, fungi, or mildew. So in 2008, EPA said that it would re-register all of its applications for triclosan, although there was overwhelming evidence of its impacts on human and environmental health. But they noted that because there's such an increase in emerging science and its health implications, that it would do its re-registration eligibility decision 10 years ahead of schedule. So the next one will come out in 2013, where it should have normally come out in 15 years. So under FIFRA, EPA can cancel a registered use of any pesticide that's found to be harmful to humans or the environment. But usually what happens is a company will get wise to the growing research about the health impacts and voluntarily withdraw its application for the product, which is what we've seen with triclosan in latex paint and food contact materials, I believe. FDA, I won't spend too much time on this. As Rolf mentioned, the tentative final monograph is still tentative and not final after 30-some years. And I just want to mention that Food and Water Watch, well, I'll get to that. The FDA announced in 2010 that it would do a year-long review of the new science on triclosan. They didn't make it very public. They just posted a triclosan What You Should Know page on their website. And it said that it would be conducting this year-long review, and the study would be completed in spring 2011. Well, we waited till spring 2011 and never saw it, so we went back to the website, and it said that they were extending their review to winter 2012. So obviously there's a need to get triclosan off the market and address these issues with the agency. So about 4 years ago, Food and Water Watch started a campaign to try to ban triclosan and educate policymakers on these regulatory gaps and get consumers and the public active on this issue. So we started thinking creatively. Well, if we can't go through FIFRA and we can't go through FFDCA, what about the Safe Drinking Water Act? Well, the Safe Drinking Water Act would restrict the use of triclosan if it were found to be harmful to the environment or humans, or what? I guess drinking water would just be humans. So the Drinking Water Act would, they have power under the Safe Drinking Water Act to take triclosan off the market, but there's no evidence that triclosan is in drinking water. No one's really monitoring that at this point. And even if they did, antibiotic resistance is not a factor that they would include in setting limits or monitoring triclosan. And then the EPA also has an endocrine disruptor screening program that has taken over 10 to 15 years to get the first tier of tests done for the first battery of classes or chemicals. So it's you know, there's dead ends all around there. So more creative thinking, what about TSCA? Well, TSCA's 30 years old, and there's a huge debate around that. And to boot, triclosan would not fall under TSCA because TSCA doesn't include pesticides. And I explained a little bit about the Safe Drinking Water Act. And so there's two possibilities that are out right now, the Safe Cosmetics Act and the Endocrine Disrupting Chemicals Exposure Elimination Act. Unfortunately, neither of them have bipartisan support, so they're just kind of there in the ether. So the bottom line is avoid antibacterial hand soaps because it's a marketing ploy.
and work with your local community and school board to try to eliminate triclosan in public places, in municipal buildings, and in schools. Thanks.
Did all the speakers want to come up and grab a chair? I'll monitor the questions. Please try and speak up. Questions from the audience? Okay, good. Yep.
So,
try and keep them short, too, because we're limited in terms of our time.
Do I understand correctly that all the chemicals that the gentleman presented and that you spoke about can be uptaken by plants, so once they're in the plants or in the animals and the pool? So they'll both move up through the food system by plants, not just aquatic.
It was an experimental study, so it was done in the lab. That's what we know from the lab. I think that the logical conclusion is that that can also happen in the real world under real world conditions.
Can I add to that? Do we have a microphone? Or
here, if you want to come up and be recorded, yeah, you could speak here, but we don't have a transportable mic.
Okay, so I think the issue here is whether triclosan that is delivered to agriculture the sludge, can make it into plants. So it's not that the sludge itself is going into the plant. It's that specific chemicals can be taken up from the soil and then migrate into the plants. The levels of chemicals that make it into the plants are rather small compared to what you put on your body, either voluntarily or involuntarily, during the day. If you want to limit your exposure, you begin with food, you will not make it very far. You have to look at the primary exposure of where these chemicals come from. The best thing to do is look at your toothpaste. If you use a toothpaste that contains 0.15% of triclosan, then your major dose will most likely come from that exposure, followed by liquid soaps. So you always have to go off to the major exposure source first. I want to state here for the record that, you know, these chemicals, triclosan, triclocarban, and antibiotics, they are not evil chemicals, you know, that are there to do us in. On the contrary, they are very useful chemicals. But it's our responsibility to figure out what is a good use and what is a bad use. And we have taken, unfortunately, more to the bad side of using these chemicals in applications where they are neither useful, not, you know, whether it makes public health sense to use them there. So we have to reconsider our uses. And so they don't belong into the everyday person's toothpaste. There are certain groups within the population, like diabetes type 2 people, they might benefit from having that and preventing gingivitis. But not every person has gingivitis, and should, you know, not every person should be medicated with all kinds of drugs that are available only because the drugs are available. And we don't apply this concept to the animal colleagues.
And I think you said this with respect to antibiotic residues in meat, but is that the driving concern with the use in livestock and poultry?
No, it's not. I really want to echo what Ralph was saying. We need to really approach this from the point of view of a strategic intervention, particularly since we're not getting anything. And I actually thought that presentation from Congresswoman Slaughter's office was very, very tragic. You know, more research is needed, more data is needed. We can't possibly think about these problems until we get more data accumulated. And at this rate, maybe by 2050, we'll have triclosan in the area and antibiotics finally out of the food supply. No. Most of the uses of antibiotics in agriculture call for a withdrawal period. Antibiotics are not persistent within organisms. They're rapidly excreted. That's why we have to take antibiotics every day when we're sick. They don't bioaccumulate in us for the most part. It's the kinds of drugs I'm talking about. And again, we have to look to where the real risks are, and that is, in the case of the antibiotic use in livestock, it's the generation of drug-resistant bacteria.
Actually, just the GAO report, just to clarify, was actually a very good report, but it didn't say let's just collect more data. What it said was we're caught in a bit of a vicious loop, I think, where various entities are saying we don't have enough data to act, but the agencies that are responsible for doing some of the regulating have not collected crucial data making it easy to say that we need more data to act.
But what is this crucial data?
Well, that's an interesting thing. You made the point, I think, that at a very basic level, we know what the issue is in microbiological terms. It's use, and use drives problems. I think there are some who say that we need to have a risk assessment for every single permutation of the link between a use and of a particular drug and a particular bug. And, you know, I share your frustration that's...
I really want to call this question.
Yeah, okay.
Every first off, we talk about various entities sort of disagreeing. No legitimate scientific or medical organization in the entire world is in disagreement. There are consensus statements from the World Health Organization, the AMA, ASM, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
There is no disagreement.
Right.
We have to get over this business because there's some well-funded crackpot on the web,
right.
Such as the Pork Board, but therefore we have, quote, disagreement. Okay, let's stop buying into that. The second is, I've said this to the FDA. What is the information you need? Would you please tell us what it is? We will then, Ralph and people in our lab and others around the world, will endeavor to find that information for you. We have tracked these bugs using molecular microbiology from the farms into the land, into the food supply, into the hospital. What is it you would like to know in order to make a decision? Let's not take refuge in this cowardly concept. And certainly here, we should not.
Okay.
We need to examine these problems.
And I certainly agree with that. And the two entities that I have heard raise concerns are the American Veterinary Medical Association and the National Pork Producers Council. But you're right. As I think we heard, over 350 other groups, including the AMA and the Academy of Pediatrics and APHA, all support the legislation that Dr. Shore talked about. So, yeah. Did you want to speak
maybe,
to that?
Maybe a quick comment.
Yeah.
Let's not complicate this issue too far. Can you think of a good reason that would justify the use of an endocrine disrupting chemical to be present in 97% of the American women's breast milk? If yes, please step up. And if no, then you know we have reached a decision here. You know, we cannot accept widespread environmental contamination. There is no dispute. There is no proven benefit. This is, if we can't make such simple decisions in our society, then God help us, because we've got bigger issues to solve. And people like Al and myself, we'd like to move on and work on, you know, on issues that are more challenging scientifically. But this looks like a no-brainer that is not going away.
Yep.
I think we all know that what's missing is the political will to do this. And what we need is for people to go to their legislative district and start lobbying as citizens and as community groups about this and start holding these people accountable in Congress.
No. There's enough blame to go around here. When we passed the Danes, a said it was because of consumer pressure. So I think that what we need to build, I don't know how to do this, is the sense that this is an important priority issue, and then that will start to influence, quote, the political will. But, you know, politicians look out on this landscape and they say, I'm not hearing anybody else about this except you. So,
that's part of what Food and Water Watch has been working on. We've had over 10,000 signatures on banning triclosan sent to members of Congress. We worked with Slaughter's office to have a congressional briefing to educate other members of Congress. So I think the work is out there, but
is it affecting consumer use?
Well, I think our citizens' petitions to EPA and FDA in 2009 and 2010, along with the briefing, have done something. I mean, FDA.
Has anyone done an opinion poll to determine whether this issue is on the radar scope of the American public? I'm not talking about inside the Beltway, usual conversations. I'm sorry, I'm just so frustrated with this issue. We always get to the same point. I do not believe this is an issue that more than 5% of the American public knows about.
No, I don't know that I agree with that. We did the polling. I work with something called Keep Antibiotics Working, and we actually did polling 10 years ago. And I agree with you that 10 years ago that the awareness level was very low. I don't believe that it's still as low as all that. But I don't think it's an either-or. I think it's a both-and. Of course, if people were to contact an elected officials, it will have an impact. Whether it will generate political will, I think, is a question of numbers. So as Winona Howder said, you know, there's various opportunities. Keep Antibiotics Working is one. SaveAntibiotics.org is another. That's a Pew-funded effort. ProtectAntibiotics.org is another. And then APHA and AMA and other groups have given their support to PAMTA, but many of you are also members of state-based organizations or other organizations. So if you go to the keepantibioticsworking.org website, you'll see the list of endorsing groups, and it helps to have more numbers of those as well.
Most groups are active around, a lot of environmental groups are active around triclosan, so NRDC and Environmental Defense Fund, Environmental Working Group. As far as I know, they haven't put as much resources into the issue as Food and Water Watch has, where it's been the main focus campaign.
And on the livestock issue, they're very active too. Sierra Club and Humane Society and Union of Concerned Scientists are all among the groups that have been working on this for several years.
Maybe I think I'd like to comment on why the chemicals are so pervasive and why it works if something doesn't work is being marketed successfully so aggressively. I think it has to do with our fear of microorganism infections. And the fear has got to be real because a lot of people die of infections. And the last thing the family, had once is the sick children around. But, what we have right now is school principals who require the use of antimicrobial products. It has to, you have to bring this to, back to school. And all the products are loaded with triclosan, even the rulers and the pens and the highlighters are impregnated with triclosan, and we are exposing the most vulnerable and susceptible population with these, and those who don't have a fully developed immune system. It makes scientifically no sense. It might make great business sense, but somebody's got to step up who has a backbone and put this thing in order.
Can the panel, and then I think we have to wrap up, but can the panel speak to how well these substances were tested for human impacts or impacts on resistance before they went on the market? I mean, is that an issue?
Well, I want to stress that the substances inherently are very beneficial. They're So that's not an issue. The issue is the specific use. The addition of antibiotics to feed was never really evaluated. This all began in 1947, and even though 1951 was a very prescient report, recording increased antibiotic resistance in bacteria from chickens fed with these new feeds, that was ignored. The actual efficacy in terms of the desired use, such as growing chickens faster or getting bugs off your hands, has never been adequately tested. But I think we have to remember we are dealing with inherently valuable and critical compounds, and in fact, that's why we are so concerned about what's going on. This is not the usual balance of dioxin versus human health or lead in gasoline and human health. This is something that is, in fact, so precious that we need to protect it from the overexploitation. It's something that we don't really seem to handle very well.
Not in terms of the human risk or environmental risk, but under FFDCA, the companies, they're allowed voluntarily to provide efficacy data on whether or not triclosan will work at an antibacterial rate for any number of products. And the only company for which there's efficacy data that says triclosan is effective is for Colgate toothpaste. So that's one registration out of hundreds.
Right.
I think there's ethical and legal implications too. I mean, first of all, we have the possibility of having false claims and misleading the population as well as professional health science. And another issue is the ethical use of information. If you go back to the, for example, triclocarban, the industry has to provide reasonable data showing that this chemical, you know, chemicals biodegrade when they enter the environment. So the chemical industry solicited a study and observed that the chemical, when exposed to food sludge, was not degrading over 6 weeks. So they tortured the microbial culture for several months until it finally adapted and degraded part of this chemical. And then they published the study, and in the abstract it said it's intrinsically readily biodegradable. That is fraud. And based on this type of information, these chemicals were assumed to be, you know, readily biodegradable. And so there's an ethical issue and there's a legal issue, and there are probably legal angles to get at. I'm not an expert in that, but it boggles mind how something can go on for so long.
Right. I think we've held the audience over, so I thank you for your patience and